Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
You talk to your kids about life. You talk about cars, you talk about love, school, music, movies, books, sports, sex, and even how to deal with law enforcement. So how do you talk to them about guns?
Since Newtown, it's really like constantly, every time it happens, there's just this big discussion for days.
It's almost easier to not think about it sometimes because the stress and anxiety it creates, it's unbelievable.
Now we need to talk. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Here we are in the wake of another school shooting, and lots of parents, I'm sure, are now having to have the shooting talk with their kids more often. Are you thinking about how to talk to your kids about their responsibility in these situations, about gun violence, about how they should protect themselves? We wanted to talk to a couple parents today about how they're discussing this with their kids. David Kotke is the father of a 7-year-old in Loveland, Colorado, and Annika Dane is the mother of a 13-year-old in Middletown, Connecticut.
My daughter is 13 years old in 7th grade, and over the last 2 years or so, basically when middle school started, she just started getting more and more afraid to go to school at all. There were some issues with bullying. There was an incident with a knife, and the school really tried to make her feel safe. They started up some like group therapy sessions with other girls in the school, and they gave her a pass so that she could leave class if she felt like she wasn't safe. But it just got worse and worse until the point last fall, she wasn't even willing to go out of the house at all, even to like visit friends or see family or go to the movies. So in January, I actually pulled her out of school entirely. We've just been homeschooling for this past spring semester.
And does the violence that she's witnessing in schools with these school shootings, has that also had an impact on her anxiety?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I would say that the anxiety actually started back in elementary school after Newtown, because I live in Connecticut, and there was like a policeman assigned to her elementary school. So every day I would drop her off or pick her up, you know, there would be like this police presence making it feel like it wasn't actually safe to be in school, even though he was obviously there to protect them. But for, you know, an 8-year-old, she doesn't get that. And then, you know, as the topic has really increased over the years, since Newtown, it's really like constantly, every time it happens, there's just this big discussion for days. And they have drills in school constantly. And it's become like a part of life, really, that we've accepted that this happens all the time. And I think that atmosphere, and also just the general atmosphere of like nobody really getting along and everybody arguing about what's right in general, but definitely as regards to guns, has really created like this really frightening place to be for a kid, and especially a girl.
David, I want to turn to you for a second. You also have a daughter. How does she feel being in school? Does she feel safe?
Well, my daughter's in first grade, so at this age, it's really hard to be able to have a conversation about what's going on because she's just too young to be able to handle that mentally. But as her father, I can say I don't feel safe for her based on everything that's been going on. And especially after the Newtown incident, it made me realize that no school is safe, even elementary schools. And so I don't feel that my daughter's safe at school because I know just reaching out and not getting any response from the local school board about what they're doing about it doesn't seem like anything's being done. The most response I've gotten has been from local police department, and you know, they said they're working with the school board, but it seems like it's always kind of a pass between both of them and kind of passing the buck back and forth. And it seems like the schools, they don't have the funding to pay the teachers, let alone puts bulletproof glass in doors or anything like that, or use or means that, you know, of security that could slow down an assailant and give police time to respond.
And I wonder, we heard Annika said that she pulled her daughter out of school. David, have you considered homeschooling as an option at this point?
We have. We're looking into online options, and Colorado has some online public school accredited programs and also private charter homeschooling options. You know, we refuse to live in fear and wait for it to happen in our community. And, you know, it's mind-boggling to me that there's just been such a lackadaisical approach to this whole thing. And while we're all sitting around discussing and talking about it, children are being murdered every week in this country. It's disgusting.
Let's circle back for a second. And I know, I'm sure when you both were growing up, and I know when I was growing up, we all used to have a talk, sort of a rite of passage, where you had the dreaded sex talk with your parents, or the talk about drugs, or, you know, all these awkward, uncomfortable conversations we have to have with our parents. And if you're a Black American, you have the talk about how to deal with law enforcement. Are we in a new place in this United States where we now have to have a mass shootings talk with our children?
I think we are. And I, what's disgusting to me is that we have to discern between a small mass shooting and a large mass shooting, and how it's become just so commonplace now that it's almost easier to not think about it sometimes, because the stress and anxiety it creates, it's unbelievable. And, you know, I remember when I was in high school, my biggest fear was being punched by a bully, not being shot by one.
I feel it's really important to have these discussions with my daughter, because especially with her anxiety, she finds out about these things, whether I talk to her about it or not. We don't even have like regular television news or anything, but it's everywhere online, and kids are online, whatever you do. And she speaks with, like, she has a friend who lives in Florida. And so it was like she had a whole conversation with her for hours, her friend, even though she was nowhere near Parkland. Just the idea that it was her state was really frightening. And Eris was like the person that she reached out to. And Eris was like, yeah, it happened in my state too. And it's like really depressing to me that these, you know, 13-year-olds are having this conversation about how common it is. And so I don't want them to be like just discussing it amongst themselves. I think it's important for me to be able to come in and say, we are trying to make it safer. And that's why, you know, all of these different programs are happening. And that's why, like, you have these drills, and it's not to make you more scared. It's to try to make you feel like they can handle it. And, you know, when she was in school, if anything ever happened, you know, whether it was a shooting or like a tornado or whatever, I would be immediately there, and I would get to you and just make her feel like that she has that connection. But it's terrifying for me to think about if I ever actually had to do that. Like, I have an anxiety attack too, because I don't want to think about how horrible that would be, and how many parents are actually having to do it every day.
And David, you mentioned being, you know, when you were in high school or junior high school, I'm sure I similarly had similar experiences. The worst thing was getting bullied and maybe getting punched, you know, a physical fight or something like that. This is now elevated to a level in the United States that we're seeing children essentially killing children. Do either of you have any sense where this is coming from? Whether it's culturally in the United States, can parents do more? I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
I mean, I personally think that gun culture in America has pretty much just gotten out of control. It's a braggadocious type thing where people like to brag about their guns. They like to put stickers on their cars with assault rifles and NRA. And, you know, I think it's just an utter lack of respect for life. And, you know, people value their guns and their rights to own any kind of weapon they want over human life. And that's a real problem. We can point it to one thing or another. And some people like to blame video games. Some people like to blame movies. I've heard people blame abortions and broken households and families that don't have fathers as reasons. I mean, some of the reasons are utterly ridiculous, and some of them might merit a little more attention. But I do know one thing. I think people, particularly gun owner, owning households and people who have this braggadocious sense about guns and kind of view them as toys, we really need to scrutinize them more. And, you know, public enemy number one is with the white male with an assault rifle, you know, not a Middle Eastern terrorist. And, you know, things definitely have changed in this country. And I think we're all kind of reeling as to what to do and what to make of it, because no matter what laws we pass, there's still going to be a wash of guns in America.
David Kottke is a father of a 7-year-old in Loveland, Colorado, and Annika Dane is the mother of a 13-year-old in Middletown, Connecticut. Thanks to you both for sharing your story.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Frances Arujo from Providence, Rhode Island. And yes, I worried about my teenage son because I know young boys are heedless and headstrong. They have a tendency to take risks that older men or older women certainly don't. There are many indications of this. Insurance rates are higher for young boys, and they have more spinal injuries than other groups of people. So, yes, I worried. I worried during the teenage years for my son.
Hi, my name is Doris, and I'm calling from Greenville, South Carolina. My daughter and son-in-law are both high school teachers. I have heard too many times for my comfort. I have the student who definitely has issues. Out of all my students, that's the one that would do something like shoot up the school. If a parent is told there are concerns regarding their child, we need to give them real support and have readily available resources. We also need to hold them accountable. Ignoring a problem does not make it go away.
You can always call us to weigh in on this topic at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway, and please use the hashtag #TheGunTalk. You get a job, your employer asks you to sign a contract, but do you really know what you're signing away? It might be more than you think. Take this story. In 2015, Jacob Lewis filed a class action lawsuit with a group of coworkers against their employer, Epic Systems. They said the company wasn't paying them the overtime they deserved. But Lewis and his coworkers had already signed a contract that forbade employees from joining class action lawsuits and required any suit to be settled by arbitration. Well, Jacob Lewis and his coworkers pushed ahead with their lawsuit anyway, and they won. But Epic Systems appealed all the way to the Supreme Court. On Monday morning, the Supreme Court agreed with Epic and decided that American workers who sign arbitration agreements cannot then band together to sue their employer. More than 60 million American workers are required to sign contracts like this as a condition of their employment, and some may not even realize it. So what does the Supreme Court ruling mean for them? We turn to Miriam Gillis. She's a professor specializing in class actions at the Benjamin Cardozo School of Law. Professor, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
So lots of questions about this. Let's do a brief lesson. What is a class action and what is arbitration? Can you explain the difference?
Sure. So a class action is a procedure, a legal procedure. It's provided for in the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, and every state has a similar rule that allows one claimant, one plaintiff, to bring a lawsuit on behalf of other similarly situated, similarly wronged individuals. And the idea is that that's a pretty efficient way of dealing with a legal dispute. So, for example, if an employee determines that she has been systematically underpaid, right? So she's supposed to get paid for a certain amount of time and the employer's shaving time off of her check. She talks to a few other people and realizes, wow, this is not just me. This is everybody. She can go to a lawyer and say to the lawyer, I believe that there's a systematic illegality going on. And the employer can bring the claim in court under Rule 23 of the Rules of Federal Procedure, but the states, again, have similar rules and can represent all of these people in one claim, which means that when you're doing, when you're trying to figure out what the employer really did, it's only, you only have to do it once. You don't have to do it a thousand times. When you're negotiating a settlement, you do it once for everyone. And because there's great power in the collective, because there's great power financially, you can get great legal help, and you can get big damages, sure, but you can also impose pretty serious remedies on the employer, a sort of thou shalt never again, right? We're all watching you. That's pretty serious power, right? And Ginsburg, in her dissent here, reminds us that that's what equals the playing field. Otherwise, employees left to their own devices will not bring claims because they can't afford to bring claims. They can't afford to get lawyers to bring those claims on their behalf. So then let's look at arbitration. Arbitration was, I think, originally intended to be a way of resolving disputes between parties of equal bargaining power, essentially having a private judge, maybe even someone with some expertise in the business's area, resolve disputes that arose between them. That makes a lot of sense, right? But these days, and basically ever since the 1990s, the Supreme Court has held that arbitration can be imposed via standard form contract in the agreements you and I sign, click, somehow agreed to all the time without even realizing we're doing so.
And you're talking specifically about, I want to make sure our listeners understand,
yes,
of course, when we all, you know, when all of us go to work at mm-hmm. some point, we'll probably be asked to fill out a bunch of forms mm-hmm. as part of our HR, mm-hmm. you know, what they call onboarding or process. So in all that, you're saying that there could be some language that most employees are not aware that they're signing off on?
Yeah, studies show us that most employees are not aware, and yes, that language is there. In this case, for example, in Epic, the employer sent around an email, and the email included a lot of different things about your first day of work, about procedures and processes at work, and in there was an arbitration clause, and the language says you are deemed to agree to this the day you finish work, the first day you're at work. So it's a condition of employment. I mean, even if we did know about it, quite frankly, I'm not sure what we do, because if everybody has an arbitration clause and you must agree to it in order to be employed, how many of us have the option of saying, you know what, I'd rather not have that paycheck.
Right.
You know, especially when we're talking about something as intangible as dispute resolution, right? I realize, you know, I've been working on this for a decade and I know it's not the sexiest topic, but because nobody thinks at the beginning of any relationship that it's going to end up in court, right?
Of course,
whether
not.
It's an employment relationship or a marriage, right? We always assume things are going to last forever. But these are issues that arise in the beginning and end up, as we can see from the decision yesterday, really harming workers at the end.
We asked some of our listeners about their experiences with arbitration, and we got this message from an employer in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, who said, and I'm quoting, "Yes, I've dealt with arbitration on the employer side. It was a waste of time and paperwork. An employee who sued really didn't have just cause, just the trumped up, quote unquote, age discrimination charge. They got a minimum amount, $3,000, and the lawyers got $5,000. That was the message. Mm-hmm. How common is that perspective among employers? Like, this is just a waste of time and money and paperwork.
Well, I think that I'd love to talk to that employer and ask him what he thinks about any kind of dispute resolution, right? I mean, look, nobody wants to ever be called to the mat and told you did something wrong. And look, sometimes employees are going to do this and it's the allegations are not just. That's what the legal system does a really good job at, of vetting claims at early stages. We have so many procedures in place for judges to decide whether there's any there. I don't know as much about arbitration because arbitration is secret. Its outcomes are not known to us. Researchers like me can't study arbitration outcomes. Everything is confidential. They don't have to rely on the rules of civil procedure, the rules of evidence. They don't even have to necessarily rely on precedent. Arbitrators can do whatever they'd like. And there are a lot of studies that show that arbitrators are basically handpicked by employers. So that's a surprising perspective. One wonders about the veracity of it.
Now, the question is also, we're talking about class actions, but what about individuals who want to sue their company for any of these perceived, whether it's pay or any other types of discrimination? Has anything changed for them?
No. I mean, we're talking about class actions because we worry that so many claims are too small to be brought on an individual basis and are therefore only valuable and worthwhile in a collective. But this affects individual claimants just as much. So if you have an individual claim and it's worthwhile for you to bring that dispute, you're going to arbitration, right? These are arbitration clauses with class action bans tucked in them. So they apply across the board.
So an individual essentially would be forced to take that claim and sit at the table mm-hmm. and get yeah. a very big, fancy, expensive lawyer and play this out. Okay. Let's take a listen. We also got another call from one of our listeners.
My name is Mike Morgan, and I'm from Rhode Island. My experience in arbitration has been positive and negative. I think it has its place, but there is also an inherent bias in the fact that the individual or the corporation who chooses the arbitrators has a conscious or unconscious bias to side with the corporation or person who hires the arbitrators.
Any final thoughts on that, Professor?
This has been well documented that, and it's pretty commonsensical if you think about it. These arbitrators, they make money. They make a salary because employers and other big companies hire them repeatedly to do these dispute resolution processes. If they don't find for their handlers some of the time, much of the time, I think they're out of a job. So there have been studies about arbitrators who find for consumers or employees too often being blackballed and not getting rehired. There are great studies showing that employers and big companies win the majority of the time. And even when the little guy does win, they win a lot less than they would in a court proceeding. So, you know, this is pretty good evidence of bias. Again, it's hard to study arbitration because it's opaque to us, right? We don't get to see what's happening in arbitration. So that makes it difficult.
Miriam Gillis is a professor specializing in class actions at the Cardozo School of Law. Thanks so much, Professor, for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Hey, we need your help. You are a big part of this show, how we think about things and how we choose what to cover. Got an idea or a guest we should talk to? Get with us on our Facebook page or call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. This is your takeaway.
When you look around your office, at your coworkers, at your managers, do they look like you? Do they come from a similar background as you? Improving diversity and inclusion should be a priority for every workplace. But if there's one place that representation really matters, it's in a newsroom.
The American newsroom is less than half as diverse as the American population. And even when you factor in the fact that younger people are more likely to be Latino or non-white, it's still a pretty shocking statistic that we are that far behind.
Farai Chidea is a program officer for journalism at the Ford Foundation and a fellow at Harvard's Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy. And of course, she's been on this show many times. In a new report out today, Chidea's research into diversity of the 2016 political press corps was stymied by silence.
Most of these major news organizations declined to provide data, or just after me and my researcher querying for 2 months, solid, multiple people, they just hid. That does not speak well for the level of accountability in the American newsroom.
As a Black journalist who covered the 2016 election for the 538 newsroom, Chidea says her focus on the political press told a bigger story about the stories American newsrooms have consistently missed as a result of the lack of diversity in their ranks.
My original plan was much more complex. Here, the story became the non-reporting, lack of transparency. But what I wanted to do was actually get analytics for these teams and then run them through MIT's Media Cloud and some other content analytics engines and see if more diverse newsrooms produced different coverage. I still think that that's a worthy goal, but if you don't have the basic numbers, you can't run the more complex analytics. And so I think one of the things that we as a field, journalism, need to think about is what are we missing by the lack of transparency?
Farai, your research goes all the way back to the Kerner Commission report. Could you tell us why you chose to start there?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things is that I think historical grounding is really important. And the Kerner Commission report, if its recommendations had been followed, would have resulted in very different newsrooms in America, but also just, I think, a profoundly different civil society. So it was formed during the Johnson administration to try to figure out why there had been so-called race riots in many different cities, including Newark and Detroit. And essentially what it found was that the federal government's role in economic and racial segregation was causing people to lash out. But it also said media coverage was a huge factor, where you had people either being stereotyped or not covered, and that people had a legitimate expectation, their words, of adequate coverage in the news. And so if you think about the U.S. press being enshrined in the First Amendment, it does have a function in a democracy. And when you make people invisible or you stereotype them, you are putting your thumb on the scales of democracy.
I've often argued for more inclusion or diversity, and I think, you know, I often am met with the sort of eye roll of, well, why do we need this? Is it just, you know, so we can check boxes, right? There's a lot of folks who ask, how many black people is enough? How many brown people is enough? How many women is enough? And I don't have an answer for enough. I just think we're not there. What's your thought on that?
Yeah, I mean, a couple of the news organizations outright said, I will not give you the numbers, but even more just avoided me. Again, I was contacting four or five people at each organization, some of whom I knew personally who'd never responded. Among those, the only two, and I actually respect them more for declining to provide data than from hiding, but it was the Wall Street Journal and CBS declined to provide data. And their answers were sort of along the lines of, we don't talk about employee matters or, you know, but it's like, well, this is not really an employee matter. This is a systemic issue that's deserving of research attention. And I bring up the example of Kai Wright, who is here at WNYC now, but he wrote a piece about his parents losing their home to predatory mortgage lending. And as, you know, a black family in America, they were much more likely to, as was the case, have been steered into a subprime loan when they qualified for a conventional mortgage. And so I think about it this way. You know, Kai's reporting showed how profound the predatory lending in communities of color was. This wave hit before the main mortgage crisis wave. Because people of color were not consistently covered from an overall economic and housing standpoint, people missed this wave of predatory lending. We could have actually slowed or prevented a lot of the losses in the mortgage market if we had paid attention to the lives of black and brown people.
You mentioned two newsrooms that didn't provide data, but you did get data from other newsrooms. Tell us a little bit about those and how did they stack up against each other?
Yeah, so I got data from five newsrooms, but only four provided their political press corps data. Some of them said, oh, well, we don't break it out and, you know, we're going to give you the overall. But they ranged from 10%, you know, non-white or Latino reporters at the New York Times, both to black women in that case, to 32% people of color at NPR, which was the highest figure, but interestingly included African-Americans and Asian-Americans, but no Latinos in the mix. And so I found that no reporting team that gave me the granular numbers actually had white, African American, Latino, and Asian.
Wow.
You know, yeah. Some had only one. So, you know, it's like it's just really interesting to me. And I think that when you have a more diverse team, you send different types of people into the field, you get different responses. Isn't that what you want? If you have a robust newsroom, don't you want people coming back? And, you know, if you sent a white male reporter and me to a Trump rally, we'd probably have been treated differently. And that actually would have been healthy for the newsroom, you know, to understand that.
Let's talk about solutions. What can actually be done? I mean, I feel like we've been, you and I and everybody who's involved in this conversation has been talking about this for so long. What can we do, Farai?
Well, I mean, again, the reason that I keep going back to acquiring these diversity statistics is not because I think that they alone solve anything. They give us an analytical framework to understand what we need to work on. And so I think that some of the findings out of this, I would say, is that newsrooms should be planning their 2020 political teams now. And if they're not comfortable with the level of diversity in their 2020 political teams, they better figure out how to recruit internally or externally. But on a broader level, having the numbers is really about just keeping track of where there's resistance inside newsrooms to change. It's really important to understand that it has been hard, it will be hard, and there will be resistance. And newsrooms have to have an internally consistent policy about how to deal with resistance to integration.
Farai Chidea is a program officer for journalism at the Ford Foundation and worked on this research while a fellow at Harvard's Shorenstein Center for Media, Politics, and Public Policy. Farai, thank you so much.
Thanks, Tanzina.
And if you're curious about how New York Public Radio is doing when it comes to diversity in our own workplace, the numbers are public. For the period of July 1st, 2016 through June 30th, 2017, NYPR's total workforce was 53% women and 47% men. People of color comprised 28% of the newsroom, and you can find out more by going to wnyc.org/about/review. So how do you make your newsroom or any industry more inclusive? Here's a couple tips from me, and I'll actually be tweeting the rest of these out, so follow me at Tanzina Vega. First of all, don't think of it as a trend. It's imperative to make sure that your coverage or your product is better and more accurate and more nuanced. Pay attention to how you treat different staff members and try to confront your own internal biases. And of course, don't forget about class diversity in addition to gender and race and so many other layers. Do you have any other tips? Do you agree with me or disagree with me? Tweet me at Tanzina Vega. You can always find us on Facebook and leave a comment there. And of course, you can call us to talk about anything at 8778-MYTAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. And we really appreciate your listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.